This talk is called The Moral Critics of Capitalism, and my hope is to move expeditiously and efficiently so that you have plenty of time to object and raise questions. Notice it's The Moral Critics of Capitalism. I'm going to say some nice things about capitalism at the end, but what I want to focus on is what I think are mistaken arguments of moral critics of capitalism. And as a brief prelude, I want to tell you my background. I came into economics from theology. I was a theology student preparing for a career in the ministry, Lutheran. I've since become an Episcopalian, but after my first year at the seminary, I met a little girl who had me read Marx, and I got radicalized. And I came back to the seminary and started shooting off my mouth. Some older and wiser friends suggested that maybe I was on the right track, but I ought to learn some economics first. So I started studying economics. And gradually, I discovered that all of the moral criticisms, almost all of the moral criticisms of capitalism that I had been so triumphantly parading around at the seminary campus were misunderstandings. And I want to review some of those criticisms, which I think are based on misunderstanding. I've got six basic errors of the moral critics, and then I want to finish up with one neglected but valid criticism before singing a little paean in praise of capitalism. But let me explain. But I don't like the term capitalism. It's a bad term. I'm really talking about market-coordinated social systems. Adam Smith used the term commercial society. It's a good one. I wish it had caught on. Adam Smith says, Chapter 4, Book 1 of The Wealth of Nations, when the division of labor has thoroughly extended itself through a society, everyone lives by exchanging. Everyone becomes, in some measure, a merchant. And the society grows to be what is properly a commercial society. And you think about that. That's us. The division of labor has thoroughly extended itself through our society, and we all live by exchanging. And that, Smith says, is a commercial society. That's what the word commerce means. Commercial society has not been popular since its beginning, and it's particularly not been popular with moral critics. So let me put up on the screen I won't show them all to you at once, because if I show them all to you at once, you won't pay attention to what I'm saying. And I've got, as I say, six complaints about the moral critics of capitalism. And the first one is that the critics pay too much attention to motives and insufficient attention to consequences. Now, motives are important. I'm not downplaying motives, but for example, if a poor country has a bad harvest, what do? We send them food. And that's out of the goodness of our heart. But we ought to pay a little attention to the consequences. When we send food, shiploads of food to Pakistan, what we do is we depress the price of wheat for Pakistani farmers, and we interfere in the long run with the development of Pakistani agriculture. What we ought to send to Pakistan is money, because the money can be used to buy both Pakistani wheat and U.S. wheat. But it's interesting how many people think that it is nobler by far to send them wheat than to send them money. And that's, okay. Another example, which I won't go into at all, but when rents start rising and poor people find they can't continue living where they are, we impose rent controls. We've got to do something for the poor people, but we don't look at the consequences of rent controls. Assar Lindbeck once remarked that next to saturation bombing, rent controls are probably the most effective way of destroying a city. And I think we have to pay attention to the consequences of rent controls. There are things that I would like to do for people who cannot afford to live in apartments in which they've been living for a long time, but I want to pay some attention to the consequences of what we do. So that's my first criticism. What I'm doing is I'm criticizing the critics. I'm criticizing the critics, all right? The second criticism that I don't like, I don't know how you put this, too many negatives here, but you know what I mean. The critics of capitalism, and by the way, all of these are sins that I myself committed in my youth. Now that I am mature, of course, I commit no sins. Failure to understand correctly the motives that actually operate in the capitalist system, the worst mistake of all, and many economists participate in this, is confusing selfish behavior with self-interested behavior. A market system presupposes self-interested behavior, but whether that is selfish behavior is a matter for empirical determination. I am engaged in self-interested behavior right now when I accepted this invitation. I did it because I was interested in promoting the projects that interest me. I think this is an important topic. I'd like to get people to think about it. I'm interested in that.
I'm engaging in self-interested action right now. Is it selfish? Well, you know, you can say it as well, yeah, what you really want is you want fame, you want people to smile at you. But that's a silly game, isn't it? If you turn everything people do into selfishness, and when somebody risks his life to run into a burning building to save a baby, and you say it was selfish, he was thinking of the glory and all of that, that's just absurd. We want to distinguish between self-interested behavior, which is what a market system presupposes. Individuals in control of property and using that property to pursue the projects that interest them. We want to distinguish that from selfish behavior. And I'm not saying there's no selfish behavior in the world, but there's a lot less of it than we are wont to assume. And related to this is the fact that I think most people have never really reflected seriously on the motives, the actual motives that operate in a business community. What is it that business executives are thinking about when they're engaged in their work? Are they, when they're sitting there trying to devise a new project or come up with a new campaign or reorganize something or the other, are they thinking about getting more money? Well, let me ask you, when you're engaged in self-interested behavior, what are you focusing on? When I was preparing this talk, even if I had been promised $2,000 to prepare this talk, prepare and deliver it, I would not have been thinking of the money when I was preparing the talk. My motive would have been try to be clear, direct. I think business, particularly successful business people, are much more interested in the challenge of the job than they are in making additional money. I mean, that's the motive that's actually operating to drive them at any particular time. All right, proposition three. I'm moving right along here. There'll be time for discussion. This is important. Failure to see that competition is the result of scarcity, not of capitalism. I see a lot of familiar faces out there. That means these are people who have heard me talk, and so some of this stuff will be familiar to you. That's the trouble with the last lecture. Your last lecture is given to people who know everything you want to say. Competition is the result of scarcity. You see, scarcity means that everybody can't get as much as they would like. All right, if goods are scarce, they must be rationed in some fashion. Rationing means allocating the goods according to some kind of discriminatory criteria. All right, once those discriminatory criteria are discovered, people strive to meet the criteria that are being used to allocate, to ration the scarce goods they want. And that is what the economist means by competition. Striving to satisfy the criteria that you think are being used to allocate the scarce goods you want. So the grocer strives to satisfy the criteria that are being used by shoppers to choose a store and so on. I'm competing right now. I'm competing for your attention, which is a scarce good. And I'm looking for the criteria that you are using to allocate your attention. I'm trying to satisfy them. So competition results from scarcity. And even Bill Gates faces scarcity because he faces a scarcity of time. Life is limited. So the only way we're going to eliminate competition is by eliminating scarcity, and the only way we're going to eliminate scarcity is by becoming immortal. And then the danger is that we'll all be bored. Nothing will happen. Okay, what matters, you see, even this struck me once. I served for a year on the allocation panel of the Seattle United Way Fund. I was on the addiction and alcoholism panel, and we had the job of allocating scarce funds to the various organizations that were working with addicts and alcoholics. And I vividly realized as these different organizations came in and pleaded for money and explained why they should get it, that saints compete too. Saints compete presumably to do good works, but they compete for the causes in which they're interested. What matters is not competition, but the rules of the game. The trick is to create rules of the game that cause competition to be a positive sum game instead of a negative sum game. And capitalism, I just would suggest, does that. The rules of the game in capitalism are basically property is clearly owned by someone who can use it within the laws and the functioning morality and conventions of the society to further their own purposes. And as Adam Smith pointed out long ago, there is an invisible hand that tends to produce the public interest out of that. The people in the capitalist system who are competing under the rules of our game tend to serve others. That's the way you succeed, and that's good. That's a lot better than rules of the game that say you win by killing others or by beating the crap out of them or something like that. Okay, number four, failure to appreciate the importance of appropriate information to the coordination of a society characterized by extensive division of labor. A lot of economists, and my boss is here,
So I'll say this, even if you disagree. A lot of economists think that the fundamental problem of economic order is scarcity. And I don't think it is. I said scarcity is pervasive, but I think the fundamental problem is coordination. How do you coordinate activities in a society characterized by extensive division of labor? We've got these millions of people all pursuing their own projects, and somehow we manage to work together and produce stuff that we want. This glass of water, this taping machine, your clothes, food, medicines, electric toothbrushes, you name it. If you think about it, it is it's incredible that this gets coordinated. How in the world does it happen that this, I was amazed when I go to the hardware store. I'm sitting in my chair and it collapses and there's a little crazy looking nut and I go down to the hardware store and imagine somebody months ago started working on this little nut that's going to enable me to get back in my chair. How does that happen? Well, it happens basically because of prices. Prices that move up and down in response to supply and demand. We tend to think of rising prices, as rising rents drive poor people out of their apartments. All right, they do that. But they're also information. They're a signal that apartments are getting scarcer, and it's a signal to some people to start building more apartments, and to all of the people who contribute to that to start doing the things that will enable other people to build more apartments. You may have noticed how much construction is going on in Seattle in response to these rising rents. Too many people, moral critics of capitalism, see prices simply as a way of getting rich. They don't recognize that prices formulated by supply and demand are information, as well as incentive, absolutely essential information to the successful working of a society such as ours. Okay, number five. These are still errors of the critics of moral criticism. The belief that concepts of justice appropriate to a family or other small community can be justly applied to participants in a capitalist system. I guess the best illustration of what I mean here is the social responsibility of business doctrine. You hear this a lot. Nike has been under attack for paying low wages in Indonesia or somewhere. Well, I don't want to get into the pros and cons of that, but stop to think about what you're suggesting if you start to criticize Nike. What are you suggesting? You're suggesting that the people who head Nike should pay workers what? What they deserve? That's not possible. It's just not possible. We don't know enough. The executive, somebody who owns his own business, or her own business, owns it completely, can do as they please. If they want to spend their money hiring left-handed African-American lesbian women, they can do so. That's their privilege, and it's their money, and they can spend it any way they want to. But somebody who is managing a large corporation, managing other people's resources, can't do that. They are under an obligation to manage those resources efficiently. And what does efficiently mean? It means managing them so as to extract from them the greatest possible net value. And that turns out to mean maximizing the value of the shareholders' holdings. And you say, oh, that's so greedy, that's so selfish, that's so money-oriented. But that's what makes the system hold together and work. And notice the alternative. To say that corporate executives should be, well, they should obey the environmental laws, they should obey the laws about racial discrimination and sexual discrimination, they should obey all the laws and the moral rules of the society. But what I'm saying, they should not be asked to go beyond that. Because to ask them to go beyond that is to turn them into unelected benevolent despots. And I don't like that. I don't think that's just. If some corporate executive has so much power that we have to plead with him to behave beyond the call of duty, to engage in acts of supererogation, then I say we got to diminish his power. What we sometimes forget is that it is simply, you can distribute in my family, at least when the kids were small and all living at home, we tended to distribute from each according to his ability, to each according to his need. And that meant that I always took the garbage out. You can do that in a family, in a small community, and that's wonderful, but you can't do it in a capitalist system. You cannot distribute from each according to his ability to each according to his need. It's an epistemological impossibility, it's a political impossibility, and it is an ethical impossibility. Okay, what's the principle we use in a capitalist system? It's from each according to his choice, to each according to the perceived value by others of his contribution. Right? From each according to his choice. And of course, that choice is constrained. I mean, lots of us would like to supply, I would like to supply a, I also wanted to supply middle linebacker services for the Detroit Lions. But I was constrained by certain physical limitations and other things. So, given what we have, and it's not always fair what we have, but given what we have, we contribute what we choose to contribute, and then we receive according to how other people value our contributions. Notice, please, that that's not the end of the story. The market, there are institutions outside the market. There are families. Infants, for example, they receive a good deal more than the value of their contribution. All right, so we this is not an attack on the welfare state or on families or anything like that. I'm just trying to point out that the moral critics of market systems are confused. Finally, the last criticism that I don't like is it's the habit of assuming that a divine perspective can be applied by human beings. What do I mean by that? Well, the best example probably is justice. I still operate in theological circles. I associate with a lot of clergymen, and they like to quote the Old Testament. Let justice rain down. Let justice flow like water. And what they're talking about is God's justice. Now, God has some advantages over the rest of us. She is, to begin with, omniscient. She is presumably impartial and benevolent, and we are not. Frank Knight, the economist from whom I probably learned more than any other single economist, used to say, "The pursuit of justice will destroy the world." I like to ask people, what is justice? And what do they say? So I would ask you, what's justice? In fact, I'll start talking about justice, and people will say, well, who's to say? Now, careful. I suggest to you, and this is something I want you to think about the rest of the day, because this is designed to get you thinking, is that we cannot define justice. It's hopeless. Justice is something for God. What we can do is recognize injustice and move to correct it, to diminish it, to attack it. And what is injustice? I submit that there's a substantial consensus in this room. Injustice is treating others in violation of the rules. Treating others in violation of the rules. What rules? The rules that they were counting on. In the United States, those rules are somewhat different from the rules in China, quite a bit different from the rules in China. But those are constitutional rules, legal rules, moral rules. I was years ago, I was talking to a student, I was trying to get some students to discuss fair employment housing legislation. And I asked the student, well, is this good legislation? And he said, well, I think it is. I said, why? He said, well, because that's my opinion. I said, well, I know it's your opinion, but is this fair? Is it fair to tell a landlord that he can't rent to anybody he wants to? Yes. I said, why? Because, well, that's the way I was brought up. I said, were you brought up correctly? He said, who's to say? I said, you're to say. Were you brought up correctly? Did you change that? He said, it's all relative. It's all relative. I said, okay, that's stupid, and I'm going to flunk you. And he yelled back, that's not fair. And he was right. That's not fair. Okay. So, now, I said I had a moral argument, a neglected moral argument that I think is important, that used to be made. In the early 19th century, it was made, and then it got neglected. Capitalism subverts community. Why? Two ways. One is, it makes us wealthy. And the wealthier we are, the less we need one another. Right? We are not very dependent on others. And another thing, very important to recognize, Adam Smith says, in a commercial society, man has constant occasion for the help of his brethren. He should have said, and sister, and we know that, but he didn't. Man has constant occasion for the help of his brethren, but not for the help of any particular brother or sister. We are extremely interdependent. I mean, there's almost nothing I can do for myself. I'm particularly incompetent in all respects. I can't grow my own food, build my own housing, grow my own food. I would die in a short period of time were it not for the ministrations of others. But here's the kicker. It's not any particular others. If I go to the grocery store and they don't treat me like a king, I go to another grocery store. And that makes us independent of other people. I have friends who say that government and the welfare system has destroyed neighborhoods and communities. Maybe it has to some extent, but the big destroyer of community is the Yellow Pages. Right? Because you don't need anybody, you just look it up in the Yellow Pages. You got to, once your piano moved, you don't have to establish a relationship with your neighbors. Just look in the Yellow Pages, moving and hauling. And that's the nice thing about that, too, is when you bring in somebody to move and haul out of the Yellow Pages, you don't have to establish a relationship with them. Right? They're an it, not a thou. Now, capitalism, I think this is very important. And I think way down at the bottom, this is the fundamental source of the moral dissatisfaction with capitalism, that it subverts community, and we are all fond of community. But my advice to you is find ways to nurture community without destroying the market. Don't expect the market to generate community. It won't do it. It'll give you little things like these little things come. I've noticed more and more Seattleites now are saying thank you to the bus driver when they get off the bus. I started doing that when I came back from Australia about 15 years ago because they did that in Australia. I thought that was nice. And when I cross the street as a pedestrian and a motorist stops for me, in fact, sometimes I'll deliberately make motorists stop for me when I could have waited so that I can thank them. Well, now, you think about it. What I think I'm doing is knitting very thin threads of community. And that stuff is important, but don't expect that to be satisfactory. Genuine, satisfying communal relationships have to be much more small-scale, personal, face-to-face, strongly nurtured. And the reason that we're in trouble is because we aren't doing what we need to do to nurture community. We won't get it by trying to turn the market into some vast California hot tub. Okay, I got some ethical arguments for capitalism, and I have four of them. I said I wasn't going to sing the praises of capitalism, but where's my watch? I said I'd finish in half an hour, and I'm going to. Here, I think, are some ethical arguments for. Notice I didn't say it creates wealth. I said it furthers human purposes. And that may be comfort. Maybe health, longevity, knowledge. Capitalism furthers knowledge. There's a wonderful book called The Logic of Liberty by Michael Polanyi. Died about 15 years ago, I think. Polanyi was a Hungarian scientist, very fine scientist. I think if he'd stayed in science, he might have gotten a Nobel Prize. Specialized in crystallography. Was a Jew. He moved to Britain in the 1930s. And there became concerned about the movement toward the planning of science and turned his attention to philosophy and became, in my judgment, one of the most distinguished philosophers of the 20th century. Bill, I don't know what you think about that. You ever read Michael Polanyi? Well, I like him. A very interesting guy. But anyway, he, in The Logic of Liberty, he points out the links between the way in which science works and the way in which markets work. You can't plan science like you can't plan markets. Individuals have to come up with ideas, push them, marshal the resources, be entrepreneurs, and that's the way knowledge grows. All right, the second of four good things I want to say is it evolves spontaneously unless overwhelming forces muster to prevent it. It's kind of a natural law argument. The thing about capitalism is that you don't have to create it. You got to stop it from being created. Now, you can create such a mess in the society that it's almost impossible for it to evolve, and I would say the Russians have come close to doing that. I mean, if you absolutely destroy civil society, it's very difficult for evolution to occur. But capitalism is a system that evolves naturally unless overwhelming force is invoked to prevent it from happening. And I think that's in its favor. Another thing is very important to me is it employs persuasion rather than coercion. Another one of my intellectual heroes is Alfred North Whitehead, who in his book Adventures of Ideas tends to see the movement of human history as a movement from coercion toward persuasion. And what's the difference? The difference is coercion is inducing people to do what you want by threatening to remove some of the options they already have. Persuasion is inducing people to do what you want by promising them some options they do not yet have. Persuasion is the method of sweetness. I'm trying to persuade you right now. Deirdre McCloskey, an economist who may become the first female economist to win the Nobel Prize in economics, which would be a bit of an irony. Deirdre McCloskey once contrasted the word persuasion, which she said comes from the Latin word for sweet, with the word convince. And convince comes from vinco, conquer, Caesar, vidi, vidi, vinci. Vinci, conquer, convince. To convince someone is to beat them up. To persuade them is to offer more attractive options. And finally, I think capitalism has demonstrated ability to counter the human desire to domineer. In The Wealth of Nations, Adam Smith said, argues it, slavery was unprofitable. But why did it persist? He said, men love to domineer. They would rather tell other people what they got to do than persuade them. And the nice thing about capitalism is it undermines attempts to domineer. All right, that's my case against the moral critics of capitalism. I think it's very important. I still got 45 seconds before it's 1 o'clock. And I have come to the conclusion in recent years that I do a lot of teaching of introductory economics. And I love it. I think it's important. And I've been frustrated over the years, not so much with my students, because students, you know, they're obedient. They do what you tell them. They may not believe what you say, but they won't let you know that. But bright, sensitive people tend to resist economics. And I think they resist it in part because they see it as a defense, an ideological defense of an immoral system. And so I think it's very important that economists not contribute to this myth that capitalism is an immoral system. And my last lecture here has been designed to plant in your minds the thought that capitalism is not an immoral system. It's not a perfect system, but it's not an immoral system. And those who condemn it on moral grounds are, for the most part, confused. If we can just see that, we can get to work at understanding it and harnessing it and improving the rules and nurturing community and doing those things that will make for a better society instead of shouting at each other. All right, I'm through. You've got time for objections, questions, comments.